So this is lecture number two in the endocrine system. And I want to just kind of give you the big picture. It's most accurate to think about the brain and therefore the hypothalamus as the true master gland of the endocrine system. The hypothalamus, as we know, communicates directly with the pituitary, which then will influence a variety of other endocrine glands and body tissues through the release of a host of different hormones. So my metaphor here is, if the brain hypothalamus is the president of the endocrine system, then the pituitary gland is the vice president. And what you're going to hear about in this lecture is we're going to examine all the other endocrine glands, not all of them, but you know most of them, some of which report directly to the president and vice president, and some which are a little bit more independent. We'll begin with the pineal gland. The pineal gland is located deep inside your brain, and it secretes a hormone by the name, first of all, let's make sure we can say this, pineal gland. One more time, pineal gland. Good. The hormone it secretes is melatonin. Let's say that, melatonin. Very good. And the synthesis and release of melatonin is stimulated by darkness. So when you guys went, you know, when the sun went down yesterday, your pineal gland stopped synthesizing and releasing melatonin. But then it turns out that it is inhibited, it's stimulated, so it produced more melatonin and released more melatonin. Then this morning, it's inhibited by light. So this morning when you woke up, you know, there was light. That is when it was stopped. So it stopped synthesizing and releasing melatonin. And so therefore, you could probably assume that the levels of melatonin, obviously they rise and fall on a sort of a daily cycle. And there's a technical term for this. It's called a circadian cycle. It's a word you need to know. So let's all say that, circadian cycle. Okay, so that means daily cycle, sort of a 24-hour cycle. And it's believed that it helps function in our biological rhythms. We have these biorhythms which sort of follow a 24-hour cycle, and melatonin may somehow be connected to that. It's not fully understood yet. What's really crazy, this is the one hormone, I don't know of any others, that you can actually purchase over the counter. So this afternoon after school, if you'd like, you can go to Walgreens and you can just buy yourself some melatonin. Go home and take it tonight. Why not, you know? So if you want to, like, actually take a hormone, you could actually just buy and take a hormone. I don't recommend it, but you can do it. Yeah. No, it doesn't. What it does is it seems to promote sleep. Okay, that's what we think it does. And in fact, it turns out that some people believe that because it promotes sleep, it's a great way to counteract jet lag. And so they'll go down to Walgreens before they go on a trip, you know, overseas, and they'll buy some melatonin and they'll use it in order to sort of break that jet lag cycle. I just got back from Palau on Sunday, and so I was, you know, totally off, you know, because it's on the other side of the international date line, very close to the Philippines. And so I'm still messed up. I'm, you know, midnight and I can't sleep and so forth. And so, you know, maybe I should go out and get some melatonin. I've read different things and I don't, you know, I'm not sure it really works, because I've talked to people who say, oh, it doesn't work, and other people swear by it, so who knows. Okay, the thyroid gland. The thyroid, which is located in your neck, and you know, if you try to feel it in your neck, you really can't feel it. You know, I can't feel it, at least. You know, it's maybe there, but I'm not a doctor, and I can't tell. All I can feel, the one thing I can feel in my neck, of course, is the trachea. You can feel the cartilages in your, you know, the rings of cartilage, right, in your trachea, but I can never feel this thyroid gland. But it is there, unless you've had it removed for some reason. And it produces three hormones. Two of the hormones deal with metabolism, and they're pronounced as follows. Thyroxine, can you all say that for me? It's abbreviated T4. And the other one is a little tougher, triiodothyronine. Triiodothyronine. Let's try that. Or T3 for short. Now, the reason they have these abbreviations is because both of these molecules have iodine atoms attached to them. And the one that says T4 has four iodine atoms, and the one that says T3 has three iodine atoms. And so that's where they get that designation. Now, there's another hormone that does something completely different from what T3 and T4 deal with. And it deals with calcium levels in the blood. Now, calcium is important in the blood for several reasons, but one of the big reasons is calcium is important in muscle contraction. And so there's a muscle that is being active your whole life, 24/7. What muscle is that? Your heart. You know, so obviously calcium is really important ion in your blood because you have to have the right amount of calcium in order for your all your muscles to contract. And the hormone that controls that is calcitonin. Can you all say that for me? Calcitonin, good. So let's take a little bit closer look at these. It turns out that tyrosine, you guys maybe remember this, when we studied at the beginning of the year, we studied amino acids, right? There's 20 different amino acids. Let's just do a quick review of some biochemistry. Remember that an amino acid is based on a carbon molecule that is surrounded by four things: an amino group, NH2, an acid group, COH, and then double bonded O. That's the acid, the carboxylic acid, and that's of course where it gets its name, amino acid. Then another group that comes off is just a hydrogen. And then finally, you have this crazy thing called an R group, and that's, remember, what makes each amino acid different from every other amino acid. They all have different R groups. Well, what happens here is that you modify tyrosine, and the modification of tyrosine will produce either T3 or T4, and you can see them illustrated here. And you'll also see that in T3, yes, like I told you, there are three iodine atoms, and in T4, there's four iodine atoms. So that's the big difference between those two. Okay, now just kind of a review from yesterday's lecture. If you remember, I said there are three different sort of families of hormones. I said some hormones are proteins. That's a chain of amino acids. I said some are modified amino acids, and then some are steroids or based on steroids. And this is an example of hormones that are based on a modification of an amino acid, in this case, tyrosine, okay? So what's the function of T3 and T4? Well, first of all, it's very important in proper development of organisms. It's really important. And number two, it's important in metabolism and in maintaining homeostasis, you know, that all these, you know, that your body kind of stays at a constant temperature, constant blood pressure, constant heart, you know, rate, and all this kind of stuff, you know, just in general. If T3 and T4, if you increase the amounts of these hormones in your body, you're going to increase the rate of oxygen consumption, and therefore you're going to increase cellular metabolism, right? Cellular respiration is going to go up. Turns out that, you know, these hormones are important in maintaining normal blood pressure, normal heart rate, and so forth. Now, what if you have a problem? What if you have hypothyroidism? Now, hypo means less than. So if you have hypothyroidism, you have less T3 and T4 than you normally should. And if this happens on a consistent, you know, basis, when you're an infant or in your early development, you're going to have serious problems. And what results is what's called cretinism. Can you all say that for me? Cretinism. And that is stunted growth. So your stature will be much shorter. You'll be shorter. And you'll also have stunted intelligence. It'll affect your brain development. And so you won't have as high IQ as you normally would. So it's not trivial. You've got to have the right amounts of T3 and T4 during your developmental years. Now let's say you make it to adulthood. You had the right amount of T3 and T4. But now in adulthood, you have a problem with your thyroid gland for whatever reason. and you start producing less T3 and T4. What you'll notice is you'll maybe start gaining weight because your metabolism kind of slows down. You become lethargic. You don't tolerate cold very well. You get cold very easily. So these are some symptoms of hypothyroidism. And that's, you know, maybe people start experiencing this and they're like, guy, you know, things aren't like they used to be. They go to their doctor refers them to an endocrinologist, and they do a test and they find out, yes, indeed, you're experiencing hypothyroidism. And then they have to give them hormones to bring their level of T3 and T4 up. Hyperthyroidism is the exact opposite. You have too much. And in this case, you have maybe a high body temperature, you sweat, your metabolism is so, you know, high that you lose weight, and you can also have high blood pressure. So, you know, one of the lessons that you're going to learn in this lecture that is, as we go through each of the slides, is that too much or too little of anything is not a good thing. You want to have kind of a homeostatic level that's controlled in some way. And that's going to become very clear. A goiter is interesting. A goiter is this enlargement of the thyroid when you don't have the proper amount of iodine in your diet. And this often happens in the developing world where they just don't have foods that are high in iodine. And so these people get these things, which are called goiters, and they become huge enlargements of the thyroid, and they can be kind of, you know, disturbing to look at them. And the reason, it's actually the reason that we have iodized salt. You know, you've probably seen this. If you go to your pantry tonight, you know, in your home, you'll, you know, look there and you'll probably see iodized salt. And what they've done is they've added iodine to salt because everybody uses salt. And so they figure if you put iodine in salt, you know, everyone's going to get a sufficient enough amount of iodine that they're not going to run into the problem, you know, with goiter if they don't happen to eat foods that are high in iodine. You know, and I think seafood, particularly shellfish, I think are very high in iodine. So, and there are other things as well. You can go on the internet and find out what foods are high in iodine. But the best thing is just to have iodized salt around the house, and you know, whenever you're using salt, you're getting enough iodine. Now, I'm going to warn you, the next slide I'm going to show you is what I call my goiter gross-out slide. And so before, you know, I show it to you, just be forewarned, okay? So this is what happens when you get a goiter, okay? There is a goiter. That is a huge enlargement of the thyroid gland in this person. And then people last period were going, oh, this can't be true, this is so gross. And then Anna, who is from Serbia, she's been in a nursing program there. She goes, oh, yeah, I've seen people like this in the hospital. So in Serbia, she's actually seen people exactly like this guy. And here's one that's really crazy. Watch this. Oh, yeah. That's a crazy goiter, okay? Yeah. We had a big discussion about that last period. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, so I don't know. Do the cells... do you grow more cells, or do the individual cells grow bigger? Do you have fluid? Not sure. You know. What's that? Yeah, this is just for not getting enough iodine. So make sure you have iodine in your diets, kids, okay? You don't want to look like this, okay? The thing about this picture, you guys, is this is not common in the developed world like the United States, because we get enough iodine in our diet. If a doctor saw it, they would immediately recognize it, and they would, you know, and it wouldn't be getting this big. This kind of thing happens in the developing world, where maybe these people live in rural villages. They don't see healthcare workers. They really have no idea what's going on, and you know, it's not until it just gets crazy big like this that they finally get help. Maybe go to a big city, and the doctor goes, "Oh, yeah, it's a goiter." You know, so anyhow, kind of interesting. Okay, now. Let's talk about negative feedback. This is how we control T3 and T4 levels in the body. And just a FYI for you guys, this question, this particular concept was a question, was a free response question on the College Board's AP test several years ago. So they love asking questions that deal with negative feedback, homeostatic regulation. I've told you this before, I will tell you again, make sure you know this stuff, because they love asking these kinds of questions. So here's what happens. The hypothalamus releases what's called thyroid-releasing hormone. We talked about, you know, if you look back on yesterday's lecture, you'll see, remember the relationship of the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary and, you know, how that whole thing works. So kind of, I would, when you study today's lecture, kind of go back to the pictures from yesterday's lecture so you can kind of put it all together. And this thyroid-releasing hormone goes to the anterior pituitary and stimulates it to release thyroid-stimulating hormone. That, in turn, does two things. First of all, it goes back, feeds back to the hypothalamus and tells the hypothalamus, hey, chill out. You don't need to produce as much TRH because we've got plenty of TSH here. So it kind of, you know, moderates that. Also, it goes down to the thyroid and influences the thyroid to produce T3 and T4, which are those thyroid hormones we were talking about. And then in turn, T3 and T4 also go back and negatively inhibit the hypothalamus and, you know, sort of tell it to chill out. And so it's this negative feedback that moderates the amount of T3 and T4 that are eventually produced so that you never produce too much or too little. You know, there's kind of a set point that you have. Yeah. Yeah, there's a variety of things that can cause it. You could have a problem in your feedback mechanism. You could have just a problem in your pituitary, period. You could have a problem in your thyroid gland. You know, there's a variety of different reasons that can cause the hypo or hyper. Okay, I told you there was a third hormone, and this third hormone is called calcitonin. And it's completely different in function from T3 and T4. And you might even ask, like, what's it doing in the thyroid? It, like, it's completely different. Doesn't really affect metabolism. But it's there, okay? And it's called calcitonin, and its main function is to lower calcium levels in the blood. Now, can anybody think, how would you do that? How are you going to decrease calcium levels in the blood? What would be a really easy way to do that? Anybody have any ideas? What's that? Okay, so that's really good. That's one of the things you do. You actually increase calcium excretion by the kidneys. So you actually, the kidneys get rid of it, okay? What's another way? Another way you might lower calcium levels in the blood. Now remember, in the blood. So it can still stay in the body, you just don't want it in the blood. Yeah. Exactly. Very good. You guys got it. You increase calcium uptake by the bones. Those are the two main ways our body controls calcium, lowers calcium levels in the blood. Now, once again, you need a homeostatic, you know, sort of level of calcium because you don't want too much, you don't want too little, because your muscles need a certain level of calcium in the blood at all times. Now, there is a disease you should all know about. Maybe you've heard about it. It's called osteoporosis. Can everybody say that for me? Osteoporosis. And it's the loss of bony tissue, and it results in bones becoming very brittle, and they have this higher propensity to fracture. And it can occur simply by reducing calcium uptake of bones. It weakens them. So you have to have the right amount of calcium in your bones, or else they do become brittle. Now, it's very common in postmenopausal women, and so all women should be very aware of this. And if, you know, I'm sure most of the, how many people in here have heard of osteoporosis? Raise your hand. Okay, everyone's heard of it. So just, you know, if you're a woman in particular, you should be aware of this your whole life, because you might not think anything about it. You're like, oh, I'm young, I've got good bones, no big deal. Well, when you get to be postmenopausal, it's going to become a really big deal, potentially. So you want to be just aware of what kinds of things you need to do with your health in order to make sure that this doesn't happen to you. Because, you know, what can end up happening is, let's say it affects your spine, okay, right, your spinal cord, or your vertebrae. Well, if your vertebrae become weakened, then that can, if they start compressing, then they can affect the nerves that leave your, through your spinal cord, And you can have all kinds of crazy things happen there, which will, you know, cause you enormous pain. And you can, you know, break your hip when you're older, and it's not because you fall, it's just because the bone is brittle and it just snaps. And a lot of old people, you know, they break their hip. You hear about this. And they say, oh, they fell and break their hip. Well, the question is, did they fall and break their hip, or did they break their hip and then fall, right? Because they had osteoporosis. So you got to be, you know, thinking about this. There is a treatment. There's all kinds of different, you know, you can have a calcitonin nasal spray so you can get it right into your system because you've got capillaries in your nose. There's a trade name of one of them. There's drugs you can take and so forth. So, you know, you want to consult with the proper physicians at the time to make sure that you're doing the right thing. Okay, the parathyroid gland. Now, this is kind of crazy. The word para means beside. So the parathyroid is a gland that's beside the thyroid. And if you actually look at this picture, it looks like a butterfly. The thyroid looks like a butterfly. And then you'll see what look like four spots on the wings of the butterfly. Those four spots are the parathyroid gland. You know, gland. And there's like four little things. And they're literally tissue that's kind of embedded or right next to the thyroid tissue. It's on the back side of the thyroid. And I think originally they didn't even realize it was a gland or that it even existed. They don't even notice it. But I think what happened is they removed some people's thyroid glands and they realized, oh my goodness, they're having problem with calcium metabolism. And then they realized there must be something else in the thyroid, and they discovered, oh, there is. There's this thing called the parathyroid. And what it does is it produces this hormone, parathyroid hormone, and parathyroid hormone does the exact opposite of what calcitonin does. It raises calcium levels in the blood. And you can imagine the two ways it does it. Think about what we just said. In this case, it increases calcium reabsorption by the kidneys. And what would be the other way? Yeah, it releases calcium from the bone. So there you go. Now, it turns out that 99% of all calcium in the body is found in the bones. So what you might want to think of the bones as a reservoir of calcium. And you parathyroid hormone and calcitonin moderate how much calcium you take from the bone or give back to the bone. Okay? Kind of neat. And so you keep this hopefully constant level of a calcium in your blood system. And if you look at my next slide, it's a beautiful graphic that summarizes everything I've just told you about calcitonin and parathyroid hormone. And once again, this question was on the College Board test a few years ago as well. So they love asking these homeostatic regulating questions. So this is a good thing to know as well. So I'm not going to spend any time on this picture, but you can look at it tonight, and it really sort of summarizes everything I just said. Okay, the pancreas. The pancreas, most of the pancreas is an exocrine gland, okay? And an exocrine gland is real interesting. An exo means out, right? Okay? And I'll give you an example of an exocrine gland. An exocrine gland is a gland that has a duct. And it has a duct that whatever is made in the gland, that substance goes through the duct and out of the gland. So in a good example of an exocrine gland are your sweat glands. All along the surface of your skin, you have sweat glands. They produce the sweat, which then comes out of the sweat gland through the little duct onto the surface of your skin. That's an exocrine gland. Turns out that the pancreas is an exocrine gland. We already learned about this during the digestive unit. It produces all these digestive enzymes. The digestive enzymes leave the pancreas through a duct into the duodenum, the first part of the small intestine, and then those enzymes help digest all your food, and therefore you can absorb the nutrients into your body. Now, it turns out that the pancreas also acts as an endocrine gland. Endo means in, and an endocrine gland is a what we call ductless gland. It doesn't have a duct, so it produces a substance, a chemical messenger called a hormone, and how that hormone gets around the body is it goes into the capillary beds and then circulates through the circulatory system. So there is no duct, the chemical that's produced just goes into the circulatory system. So it's kind of different. Turns out that only 1 to 2% of the pancreas is endocrine in function. The rest of the pancreas is pretty much exocrine. And so 98 to 99% is what we've already learned about. It produces all these digestive enzymes. But 1 to 2% of the pancreas is endocrine, and that's what we're going to talk about right now. And this endocrine tissue is located in what are called the islets of Langerhans. Can you all say it for me? Islets of Langerhans. And it's named after the guy who discovered it, Langerhans. And he found these little islands of tissues. And if you actually look closely at these little islands, they're actually made up of two different kinds of tissue, alpha cells and beta cells. The alpha cells secrete the hormone glucagon. Everyone say that, glucagon. The beta cells secrete the hormone insulin. Can you say insulin? Okay. And they work antagonistically, okay, as you'll see. So, once again, another great example of homeostasis. Key concept here. The blood glucose set point in most people's body is about 90 milligrams per 100 milliliters of blood. That's just the way it is, okay? Now, why do you think that your blood has to always have about 90 milligrams per 100 milliliter of glucose? Why is that the case? What organ in your body constantly requires glucose, always has to have glucose all the time, 24/7? Your brain. If your brain doesn't, you could go into a coma. So this is critical for your life. So how does this work? Turns out that after a meal, your blood glucose level goes up. Let's say, I'm just going to make up numbers. Like, let's say it goes up to 150, okay, or more. Your islets of Langerhans will release insulin, and that insulin will then lower blood glucose levels. Here's how it works. Real simple. I'm going to give you kind of a real simple way of thinking about it. Your body, the cells in your body glucose cannot come into your cells unless they're invited. And the way they get invited is by the molecule insulin. So I like to think of insulin as like a key that opens up your cells of your body and invites glucose in, okay? But without insulin, the glucose can't go into those cells. So it can stay in the blood, but it can't get into the cells. So it'll stay really high in the blood, but it can't get into the cells. So insulin is critical to invite the glucose in. Make sense? Okay. So what happens then if blood glucose drops? Let's say it goes below 90. Well, that's a problem because your brain is like, wait a minute, I need at least 90 milligrams per 100 milliliter. What happens is your islets of Langerhans will release glucagon, and that will raise blood glucose level. Now, let me ask you this. Where are you going to get the glucose? Any ideas? Where are you going to get the glucose? Okay. Glucagon helps raise the levels, but where does it get the glucose? It's got to get it from somewhere. Where is glucose stored in your body? Anybody know? Yeah. It's in the liver. And in what form is it in your liver? What's that? Glycogen. Okay, so if you remember, glycogen is a long polymer of glucose. It's hanging out in your liver. It's also in your muscles as well. And glucagon simply acts like a knife that cuts off pieces of glycogen, individual units of glucose, and releases them into the blood. So now you've brought your blood glucose level back up. Okay, Brian. No, because you got to think of it this way. There's two things going on. We're talking about the blood. Blood is in your circulatory system, right? And glucose is in your circulatory system, right? Okay? And it's cruising around all the time. So what you want to do, let's say you eat a meal, big meal, okay? All of a sudden, you've absorbed all this glucose into your blood system, your circulatory system. So now let's just say, for instance, that your blood glucose level is at 200. You don't want it there. You want it around 90. So what you need to do is you need to get it out of the blood system. How do you do that? You move it into the cells, out of the circulatory system into the cells, and insulin is what allows that to happen. Okay? Good. So the if you look at my next slide, you'll see once again a nice summary of how these antagonistic hormones work. Once again, I'll let you look at this on your own. It's a beautiful summary of everything I've said. So once again, worth learning, worth remembering, could easily appear as an AP Bio question on the College Board exam. Now, what about if you have problems with blood glucose? Well, diabetes mellitus is a big problem. Can you all say that? Diabetes mellitus. Now, the symptoms of diabetes are excessive urination. In fact, the word diabetes is the Greek word for copious urination. And also the sugar in the urine. The word mellitus is the Greek word for honey. And so if you really want to translate literally diabetes mellitus from Greek to English, it would mean pee a lot sweet urine. Okay? So people who have diabetes are people who are constantly drinking, they're constantly thirsty, and they're constantly urinating. And if they were to taste that urine, which, you know, I know it sounds disgusting, it would be very sweet. But you can just simply go to the doctor and have them test it, and it'll say, oh, it has high glucose levels. And that's pretty much, you've got diabetes. So if, you know, sometime in your life, if all of a sudden you start peeing a lot, and you're not drinking coffee, alcohol, or a lot of water, it's just, and you're always thirsty, then you might want to go to the doctor and, you know, maybe you've got diabetes. Okay, what are the reasons for the disease? Two reasons. Number one, not enough insulin is being produced. Okay, that makes sense. Or you produce insulin, but the target cells don't respond to it. They just ignore it for some reason. Okay. And either way, you get high levels of glucose in the blood, and these high levels of glucose in the blood cause glucose to be excreted by the kidney, which then draws water out of the kidney. And so that's why you have this constant need for drinking, and you produce lots of urine, and that urine is very sweet. So that's kind of how it all works. The irony is your blood is full of glucose, you just can't get it into your cells. Isn't that wild? Okay. Now, there's two types of diabetes which you should know about. Number one is what's called type 1 diabetes or juvenile diabetes. And it's called juvenile because it only happens, it appears first in little kids, you know, around 10 years old. You know, could be younger, could be a little bit older, but, you know, when you're a juvenile. And it's actually interesting. It's an autoimmune disease. It turns out that the child's immune system is attacking its pancreas cells, and it literally, this is what happens, it literally kills the beta cells. And so the beta cells are completely taken out. So these people cannot produce insulin at all. The beta cells are completely destroyed. And one of the goals of stem cell research is to take these kids and reintroduce some stem cells that can then recreate the beta cells, and then they can start producing insulin again, and then they're no longer diabetic. And in your lifetime, hopefully someone's going to figure this out using stem cells, okay? But until then, they must give daily injections of insulin for the rest of their lives. Sad. Type 2 diabetes, this is called adult onset, and this is 90% of all diabetes is you know, adult onset, and it usually appears after the age of 40. And it's totally different. These people produce insulin. No problem with producing insulin. Their problem is the cells that should respond to insulin don't. So even though there's plenty of insulin, they don't respond. And it's very strange. What causes it? We believe that one of the major causes is obesity. Okay? So if you look at people who are overweight, they tend to be diabetic. Now, we have literally an epidemic of type 2 diabetes in our country right now because so many people are overweight, and it's just skyrocketing. And if you go on my website and you want to know more about this, listen to Dr. Karp's lecture, and he'll tell you all about this epidemic, and, you know, it just goes, it's crazy. So how do you, well, you can't control, you know, it doesn't matter if you add more insulin, you know, it's not going to help you. So they have to control it differently, and they control it by diet and by exercise. And so this is how they control type 2 diabetes, okay? And if you remember the article I gave you, What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie, he mentions, you know, he talks about this issue of our diet and so forth, and, you know, why there might be this, you know, huge incidence of type 2 diabetes. Finally, there's two ways to control hormone levels and maintain homeostasis. Number one we've talked about is negative feedback. We talked about the relationship between TSH, T3, T4, and their relationship with the hypothalamus and the release of TRH. You can go back and read about that. That's one way. Another way is antagonistic hormones. And we saw that in the control of calcium blood levels, calcitonin versus parathyroid hormone. These are two hormones that are antagonistic. Also illustrated in the control of blood glucose levels, where we have insulin and glucagon. So what I want to tell you is that the College Board loves this kind of question, you guys, where you have homeostatic regulation. And there's different ways of doing it. You can do it through negative feedback, or you can do it through antagonistic hormones. And just be aware that these are two different ways that, and they're both in the endocrine system, but they both serve the same function. But, you know, just be aware of it. Okay, that's it.